everyone. Sorry to say we are interrupting our normally scheduled programming this week because we've lost a friend of the show, Joshua Clover. Joshua was on the show twice, I think, and in a moment you'll hear our interview Jamie and I did way back in 2019, taken at Commie Camp. And in that interview, we mostly talk about music, as he was a prolific music writer. He was also a poet, and I'm going to include some audio of him reading one of his poems. And of course, he was a great Marxist theorist, or a Marx-ish theorist, as he liked to say. Riot, Strike, Riot is one of the most essential theoretical works and a key piece of the communization canon, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes. But mostly, he was an incredibly kind and generous and brave comrade who, during his time at UC Davis and really everywhere he went, dedicated himself to the struggle. And he made a lot of enemies in the process, both on the right and on the left. And maybe that's not always a good thing, but in his case, it really was. We're going to have one of his closest collaborators on the show next week, I hope, Jasper Burns. And I'm sure we're going to talk more about Joshua then. And I'll also note that we've lost some other really important communists recently, including Jacques Camat, who we talked about recently with Rachel Kushner, and Cher Singh from the Indian group Communist Kranti. And so I think we'll have an episode remembering them and their work too. But I just wanted to throw this together because Joshua Clover has always been an inspiration to me, and I'll really miss him, and I'll hope you check out his work if you haven't already. So first, you're going to hear him addressing Occupy Oakland in November of 2011. This was outside the Traveler's Aid building Occupation. It was seized by the Oakland Commune. Then you'll hear him in 2006 reading a poem from his book Totality for Kids at the Bowery Poetry Club. After that, a little taste of his music criticism, reading a snippet of his book about the modern lover's Roadrunner on Eric Weisbard's YouTube show. And then finally, our interview from Antifada episode 57. So stick around for that, stay safe, and rest in peace, Joshua Clover.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6!
Other atelier.
I was asked to do some translations for a translation from the French festival they were having at NYU, I guess. People think things about me that I don't understand. I don't actually speak French, much less translate it. So of course I agreed. Wrote some poems in English with a friend of mine, translated them into French, translated them back into English, made up a French poet. This is one of the poems. It's called The Other Atelier. Revolutionary workers remember the year contains dominated sectors like syntax and the city. So begins the final report on words. Posted on handbills along the facades of Rue No Fun, the shift from modernism to world systems is stored in the new candy-colored currency. History and capital had been Astaire and Rogers, but are now Clark Kent and Superman. Taking advantage of the exchange rate, I have acquired a circa 1953. Though it meant selling the rights to the word peignoir and the neighborhood where you first heard it. Executive summary, who is free on Sundays is anything but free. Sweetly and green, 200 winters are owed the Shah of tomorrow. This is called Poem. Oh, capital, let's kiss and make up, and I'll take back all those terrible things I said about you to my friends and in poems. What do poets know of capital, anyway? It's exhilarating, the daily life of money, as it shifts and deliberates like Frank O'Hara buying gifts in a haze of cosmopolite third-worldism en route to a weekend out of town. Yet, so affectless, it becomes a signature affect. Via the artifice of the Dow Jones, you often appear to be in New York. But I suspect that if consciousness is a story, you are more like narrative structure. Is that a feeling? And so, the NASDAQ and the Bourse and the Nikkei Index cannot be said to happen any more than the sentence happens. Like true feelings, you're everywhere at once. That's Neoplatonism for your simple imminence, but either way, the road leads to St. Augustine, and don't get me started, nice city, good job. It must be hard to hold things of the world in an order while studiously skirting the question of whether you are a thing yourself. And I can imagine the anxiety this causes you, but capital, don't you ever lie on the couch near the coffee in the late morning reading for the second, third time one of the magazines you picked up in one of your supermarkets in California until you come to the photo of Britney Spears in flip-flops and drag? You know, sort of like Googling yourself. This is what I learned from the specters of Dr. Williams and the coatless Carl, who appeared to me quite early in one millennium and spoke in a single arid voice, no ideas but in money. Thus the portability and persistence of ideas that have given us so much pleasure and move as pleasure must move through the gold integument of this life. Capital, on behalf of myself and all my friends, I want to apologize for 1916 and hope we can put that behind us and do whatever it takes to feel joined to everyone else in this town and distant cities and every person in the system that is at this time and in this space that flows the world.
Ladies and gentlemen, Joshua Clover.
So from that note, let me leap into the final chapter and read a slightly longer passage about Roadrunner, and then we'll open it up to conversation. While it may not immediately appear so, it is the very same problem that we encountered first in Chuck Berry, a problem, that is to say, entangled with the birth of the genre. This is the division that appears at first in the commonplaces of cultural lore, to map directly onto that between teen and adult, innocence and experience, country boy and city lights, but is finally something else, intimately related, absolutely distinct, the fantastical separation of no particular place to go from the call to order. The division of the ring road from ring ring goes the bell. Rock and roll is premised on the separation of the joyride from the factory. In lingering with a 4-minute song about driving around at night listening to the radio, this may seem an arbitrary and abstruse place to end. And yet, that is where the song begins, in this exact separation. Jonathan is flying into the world and he recognizes his situation. That is what revelation is, after all. It's just recognition accelerated to faster miles an hour. Though he's not much of a singer, he begins to sing. He sings the world of commodities and their remnants, the entire set of sublunary things that will provision a roadrunner. But like all recognitions, this one is two-sided. And even while flying into it, he begins to withdraw. Not from the beauty, not from the unity, but from the accompanying leap. He encounters before him the made world, but the made world without its makers, just Jonathan and a road, a suburb, a state, a civilization spread out beneath the moonlight in which he might endlessly list the built, the fabricated, the pre-recorded, the artifacts of an otherwise absent race that spangle the landscape through which he rides, the only person alive, until that startling turn 3 minutes into twice when he politely requests, okay, now you say it, modern lovers, and we discover with a start that he's not alone in the car. And they sing radio on to start the call and response outro, but it is already too late. Already the other side of the ecstasy that has been thrown into stark relief, what it means and what it entails. He does not want to stop being a teenager in love with the modern world and disappear into the radio, disappear into work and professionalism, disappear into production. And is that not the utopian problem of the Ur story? The leap that it contemplates, thematizes, sustains, is the moment in which the separation is overcome, and the unity that feels holy is revealed as the simple truth that someone works at the stocking shops and the factories, someone works at the recording studios and at the record stores, all different, all the same. If he makes the leap, then he will slot in there somewhere. The utopian problem is not how to slot in the right place as the rock and roll star, but how not to disappear. From this, everything follows. He is the most amateur of amateurs. Every break and withdrawal was to preserve some fraction of this. He blew up the contract to stay an amateur. Even after he started recording the record, he blew up the band, started over and over, ended over and over. He did whatever he could to stay adjacent to the radio without ever quite disappearing into it. Maybe someday his name would be in lights. Nah, maybe not.
Communist camp. Let me describe it in detail. It is basically like the Turning Point USA conference, except it's not in a Ramada Inn convention center, and it's not filled with grifters making somehow $1 million a weekend. It's filled with really good communists sharing food, sharing ideas, playing, talking theory, making food, hiking. It's a very beautiful time. If you're a Turning Point USA person, you're living a miserable life and you should become a communist.
We're also making a lot of macrame, hammer and sickles, because that's what you do at commie camp.
I mean, yeah, not everything we do isn't atrocious. But we are talking about some high level ideas. And the recent issue of Commune, there was an essay about the work of an artist who I understand is pretty popular named Lil Nas X. I've never heard this song, Old Country Road, I think it's called, and I can't find it online. Joshua Clover's here. Could you play the song for me so I know what we're talking about?
That's my communist dream, is to play this internet sensation song for you, Andy. I'm gonna ride and turn. No, we can't. We gotta start this again.
You were doing it so good before. Come on.
It takes a while to get in key. my God, I've lost entirely. Run, gonna take my horse to the old town road. We're gonna ride until we can't no more. Gonna take my horse to the old town road. We're gonna ride until we can't no more. Can't nobody tell me nothing. Can't tell me. Okay, that's enough. I feel like that gives you a good sense of it. There's verses, but they're different.
So to me, this sounds just like a normal country song, but I understand from your article there's something peculiar about this country song.
There's a lot of peculiar things about it. I mean, it sounds like a country song right now because I'm humming and strumming on an acoustic guitar, but the song itself is built from samples that Lil Nas X and the producer of the song named Keo from the Netherlands, they bought online very cheaply. You can buy cheap samples online, and they put them together. It's got a beat that's sort of similar to trap music. And so it was a little hard for people to figure out the genre of the song. But as you note, it in many ways seems like a country song. So in its first week of appearing on the pop charts, it went rocketing up the Billboard country charts. But then a strange thing happened. What's that, you ask? I'll tell you. So it went on those charts because Lil Nas X, when he recorded it, he posted it on some online sites, and he tagged it, as you can, as a country song. So it went on those charts. But after a week, the editorial board of Billboard magazine, which is in charge of these things, they're the power that determines how the charts work, got together and decided it was not country enough. Why? Maybe it was the samples. Maybe it was the somewhat hip-hop beat. Probably it was that Lil Nas X is black. And while there have been African-American country stars, the thrust of this song and Lil Nas X's race caused Billboard to pull it from the country charts and move it to the hip-hop R&B charts, where it went on to be the most streamed song in the history of the world.
And in your article, you focus on, it's a very positive reading of this song as an example of the way the race line in the United States can be transgressed. That is shows the absurdity of it in a way. And like, not only works as this kind of act of obvious subversion that everybody that's legible to everybody, but is also just very simple. And not so, and not offensive. Like, people love it. What do you see as being the cultural significance of this song in this moment?
So, I mean, on the one hand, I never want to give songs credit for changing the world or things like this, but it did have that interesting character of a sort of magic spell or like an Emperor's New Clothes moment, where country and hip hop, there happen to be two genres I love. They've developed in parallel. They're deeply American. They draw on other national, international histories, but they're deeply American genres, but they're often set in opposition. They're both premised on performances of racial authenticity, one black and one white. And so sort of traditionally, they're thought of as antagonistic. No one could like both, and they couldn't go together. And I think underneath that is this, as I suggested, a deep kinship. A deep kinship, not just that they're both sort of amazing forms of North American indigenous music, but that they're both the musics of the proletariat. That doesn't mean all the fans are working class people by any means, but they're identified with the black proletariat and the white proletariat. And so they have this deep underlying kinship and yet exist in this perpetual antagonism. And that's interesting, like allegory about race in general, perhaps. And so along comes Lil Nas X, and although he got a bit policed by the Billboard editorial staff and so on, everyone else was sort of fine with it. And they're like, all right, it's country, it's hip-hop, fine. There wasn't a lot of freak out. There wasn't a lot of pushback. I'm sure there were some racist white dudes who were like, that's not country, I don't want to hear that trash. But there weren't that many. It wasn't a big deal. Everyone went with it, and it just really felt like something had been overcome, at least for a moment.
I don't know if you know a lot about this because it wasn't in your piece, but someone earlier today was explaining to me how this song really popped because of TikTok, which is apparently not just a song by Kesha from 2009, but a very popular new social media platform that all the kids are using.
So yeah, it was incredibly successful on TikTok and various others. I mean, so what's interesting about Lil Nas X, probably a lot of things, somewhat, I think, to various people's surprise, he turns out to be a pretty interesting character. As many people will know in the audience, he actually came out as a gay on the last day of Pride. Again, for either a hip-hop or a country star, quite an unusual occurrence. And again, it seemed sort of to be okay. But anyway, he's not just successful on TikTok and various other media and streaming platforms. He sort of is that, which is to say he's not a career musician. He's not a career anything. He's 20 years old, good Lord. But if he is anything, he is the internet, right? Before he started releasing music, which was last year, he was sort of like a meme artist, a semi-professional troll, and just sort of had this internet life. He was part of Nicki Minaj's online army of sort of supporters, and he did sort of like memes that were popular, and he just sort of embodies sort of like what it means to be the internet in 2019 or whatever year we're in. And so he slipped so easily into things like TikTok and numerous other music, media, cultural streaming platforms. I think it's going to reconfigure how people understand cultural production and distribution for the next couple of years.
How do you see the song affecting country? Do you think country is going to learn its lesson and close ranks and make sure this atrocity doesn't happen again? Or do you think country is now a contested playing field?
I think it's a contested playing field. It's also worth noting that, I mean, country is nationalistic, often racist, has all kinds of problems, but it has been trying to grapple with hip-hop for quite some time, probably about 20 years, and to figure out how to integrate it into itself, if only to draw in a greater audience or something like this. And they've tried many, many different strategies, but none of them have ever been quite like this, a sort of an indiscernibly ambiguous country hip-hop song by a black artist. The closest, there was like a country rapper named Cowboy Troy from, I don't know, a decade ago, a little bit more than that, who was, I think we have to be honest, terrible. And I think that put people off the idea of country rap and what it might be. But country has been trying either with aesthetic generosity or just imperialism to try and occupy a bit of hip-hop, and hopefully it won't just be that, like, oh, country's figured out how to sort of make money off of black people, the way that, you know, golf figured out that if you make Tiger Woods huge, you know, there's an extra $1 trillion. And I'm hoping it won't go that way, but we'll open up a little space for experimentation in country, which, as much as I love country, it's a little stagnant right now, and Lord knows it needs some breath of fresh air.
And moving back to hip-hop, you made a really interesting point early in the article about how trap is not a beat. It is a number of sounds and beats that are employed in creating what is considered that sounds like a genre because it's using the same sounds. And it felt like you were making an argument about the components of culture itself, that culture is seen as having these natural rhythms that are separate, but really the elements of it can be extracted and rearranged. And the song demonstrates that, and trap maybe is breaking out of its own trap and becoming something larger than just hip hop, right?
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think probably says a version of what I was trying to say better than I could. It's really fascinating that people always want sort of the single bullet solution. So like country is this, hip hop is this. And you know, the problem with genre is it's endlessly historically unstable. And in that, so far as it exists, it's always an ensemble of things. Some of which are very obvious to you. In country, you know, it's going to be the, you know, a banjo sound, right? Or a certain kind of country fiddle. And you think, oh, that's country. But that alone will never prove to be country. And you can always hear that country fiddle in some rock song and be like, well, that's confusing. And so there's a whole bunch of cues, some of which we register and some of which we don't, that make a genre. And because that's the case, it's always a bit flexible. You can swap one out and try a totally different new thing. So genres always have, in fact, more room to move than many might think. So trap has gotten locked into its own thing. We sort of had like developments of trap. Like, I don't know if you're familiar with drill music in the UK, which is sort of like trap plus one. And it can get locked into sort of a narrow and narrower view of itself. And that's how genres die, is they reduce themselves to a single aspect. They ride that into the ground and they're done. And then it just sort of becomes parody or something like that. But genres don't have to do that. They can say like, well, this can be a hip hop song and it can have lyrics that are about, rural agrarian lifestyle. Or it can be a country song and it can have these beats that we associate with trap. That maybe is one of the great things about the song, is it just reminds everyone that these categories have a lot more room for play in them than radio programmers think they do, than genre assholes think they do. And hopefully the people on the side of play will win until there's no more winning, because there's no more genres, because genres really only make sense in a certain kind of market scenario.
And this might be a reach, I've always been interested in how hip-hop seems to consider itself as a genre of rock. Like, country is obviously a genre of rock. Punk is obviously a genre of rock. But hip-hop stars often refer to themselves as rockers, and they think they're living the rock star lifestyle. And in a way, they are, right? What do you think of this weird idea I have?
I think that's interesting. So I'm going to agree and disagree, as one does dialectically. I'm not sure country thinks of itself as rock. Accusation has been levied against it for quite some time. This isn't real country anymore. It's just like rock country. It might as well be like arena rock, but they're just calling it country. But that's mostly an accusation from the outside. That said, the desire for genre stars to identify themselves as rock stars you're talking about, that's absolutely real. You did a reach, so I'm going to do a reach too. I think the comparison is something like the way all these social struggles will identify themselves as strikes, even though they don't look to us like strikes, they don't involve withdrawal of labor and things like this, or the human strike or so on. And you're like, why are you calling it a strike? Well, there's actually, I think, a good reason for that, which is that historically strikes have been an extremely charismatic and successful form of political struggle that people want to identify themselves with. No one wants to identify themselves with kind of like a loser approach. And similarly, like something happened with the invention of teen culture, with all the sort of excess cash flowing through the economy in the 50s and the 60s that allowed rock, which blooms in that moment, to achieve that sort of charismatic status as the pinnacle of individual cultural achievement, was to be the rock star, even more than the movie star or anything else. And so when rock started to flag in the 70s and was dead by, whenever Kurt Cobain died, there was this idea, well, we're the next rock, we're the next rock. And hip hop clearly is the obvious example of that, was the next rock and roll. And so the idea that, that was early on in hip hop, you get that nerd song, rock star, and so on. And Jay-Z calling himself a rock star over and over again. And that idea that the most charismatic, successful, rich, Learjet flying, groupie fucking musician is by definition a rock star, because that's what constitutes a rock star. So I think you're right about that, and everyone wants to be that. And how long we'll have to refer to rock, which has been dead for quite some time now, is baffling to me, but I guess it's going to go on for a while.
I think rock will live on as sort of a decadent signifier, if not an actual genre of music.
I'm sure you're right. Yeah, I'm sure that's correct.
Well, I just got one more question, and it's about or maybe we can ask some more questions about not this, but I'll just ask one more question on this subject at least. At the end of your article, you mention this trope that's emerging in cinema recently of a black man speaking with a white voice, and specifically in Get Out, Sorry to Bother You, and Black Klansman. And in these movies, you see it as like a horror element. It's a comic element, but also there's like a, it's more horror than comic in a way. This voice has transformed their lives and has kind of trapped them in this liminal space within the race line. But you see this song as adopting it just for play in a moment and it kind of breaking the horror of it. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Only to say, like, yeah, I said that. I think that's right. I actually forgot some things in that catalog. Like, there's that great episode of Atlanta with the character. Is his name, in fact, Teddy White? But he, you know, he's played by a black actor, but in total white face. It's a sort of weird fantasia about Michael Jackson. But again, it's a black body that speaks and performs as if white. And it's a horrifying episode. It's a really disturbing, vexing, somewhat comic, as all of Atlanta is, episode. So there's even more, I think, of these examples. And I am interested, beyond the question of Lil Nas X and Old Town Road, of why this particular trope is so dominant in black cinema, television right now. And I think that the underlying anxiety about recuperation, about the domination of a sort of imminent existential whiteness that, like, takes over black bodies, especially at work, but not only, is a very powerful one right now. And somehow it's enough in the air that Lil Nas X figures out, well, that's like playing with anxieties and something, like, that's always what a joke is, right? The structure of a joke is it takes a deep anxiety and gives it a little twist so that we can laugh at it. And in some sense, that's what Old Town Road is, except I don't want to reduce it to the status of a joke because it's kind of a great song.
So I realize in the rush to talk about this song, we didn't really introduce you. You are a professor, you're a writer, you're a poet, you're a rock critic. But who is Joshua Clover? How, when Joshua Clover looks at in the mirror, what does he see?
Wow, this is getting deep. I see a person who's lived all their lives just to be on podcasts, so now my dream is coming true. No, I mean, that's actually, I appreciate that question. So I feel like I spent a large chunk of my life figuring out how to bring together the fact I liked learning shit about history and economic theory and political theory and my own political commitments and investments as an organizer or whatever the term he uses. And I kind of figured that out. You know, I finally wrote a book that I felt like brought those two things together in a certain way. And that felt thrilling. And also, like, I'm sort of solved that problem. And now I have to figure out what...
Riot, strike, riot.
Yeah, and sort of solve that problem and now have to figure out what my next problem to solve is. And I'm really not sure what it is. I've been thinking a ton about pipeline blockades and how I think we're going to see a lot more of those in the future and the specific kind of political form they have and their history in relation to indigenous struggle. And I'm just starting down the path of trying to develop a way of thinking about that in the framework that I use. And that's currently what's on my mind a lot.
So we were all talking last night in the library, if you recall, and I believe you said, and I quote, "It's more important to be a communist than a Marxist." And everyone agreed with you, but that might be a hot take to some of our listeners. You care to unpack that a little?
Sure. I actually am not sure I'm the one who first said it, but I think when I agreed with it, people looked at me funny because they think of me, probably because I have a beard, they think of me as a committed Marxist. And Marx has certainly been useful to me in trying to have a framework to understand the world. I've lived with Marx, and I teach Marx to students all the time. I go through it over and over. I've reached the point where I also see real limits to it. And I think that it's like having really good, like a really safe car or something. Like, it helps avoid really bad errors that I think some people make. One of the debates we've been having here at camp is whether the entire political struggle should be directed at the idea of the state and destroying the state. And I think, you know, Marx helps me think that's a very inadequate way to imagine political struggle, and to think about the compulsions built into capital that keep on working to form states in various ways and so on. So in that sense, I found Marx incredibly useful. But I don't think Marx is a political project. I think it's an analytical method. And I found that method useful, but it does not tell me what society to make exactly or how to make it. I also don't know the answer to those questions, but I think that's one of the reasons I spend these occasions with my friends and comrades, is to try and puzzle that out. And that's not, Marx doesn't direct us toward that. He gives us tools to make analyses, but the desire for a society of things held in common, the desire for a society where you only have access to goods you need to survive if you work, that's not fundamentally Marxist, and you don't need Marx to get to that. And I think that's an incredibly important fact.
Yeah, for our listeners, maybe they have the conception of a communist camp of just being talking about Marx day in, day out, and the stuff on the board and the formulas and all this stuff. We're not really talking about Marx, and that's not because we're not Marxists here. Some of us are, some of us aren't. But the urgency that we have, the things that really brings us together, is our daily lives and our thoughts on the future. Thanks a lot for being here, Joshua. Do you have any closing thoughts or songs?
Definitely no songs. It was super generous of you to invite me to do what we'll later refer to as singing. And I appreciate the chance to talk with you all, and especially outside the context of the podcast, the chance to see you once a year, if not more often. It's great to see you there.
Thanks a lot.